Right, let's see. You're going to need waterproof boots, some waterproof trousers, a waterproof coat, of course, waterproof hat, waterproof backpack, waterproof socks, and, take my word for it, some waterproof underpants. Welcome to the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. Hello and welcome to the second season of the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. I'm your tour guide, David Mountain. You're joining me on a canoe voyage through one of the most iconic periods in prehistory, the Carboniferous. Lasting from 359 to 299 million years ago, the Carboniferous marks the penultimate period in the Paleozoic. With its endless jungles and bottomless swamps, the Carboniferous isn't the most human-friendly holiday destination, but it's certainly a memorable one. This is one of those times in our planet's history when the Earth really feels like an alien world. The plants and animals are either completely unfamiliar or weirdly out of proportion. There are giant horsetails, crocodile-sized amphibians, and some truly monstrous arthropods. To guide me through the weird world of the Carboniferous, I've recruited the help of two experts. Dr. Bill DeMichael, a paleobotanist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History.
Hello, nice to meet you.
And Dr. Russell Garwood, a paleontologist at the University of Manchester.
Hello, how's it going?
So, Bill, right now, I'm paddling through one of these swamp forests, these dense, waterlogged tropical ecosystems that really define the Carboniferous for so many visitors. So, whereabouts in the world would someone need to head to find one of these forests?
Well, first off, they're in the tropics, so you'll be looking in the Carboniferous equatorial belt, which is very different from the tropics today. The Carboniferous tropics, the continents were in different positions, and the continents were all basically aggregated into a giant supercontinent. So the equatorial belt on land would run anywhere from what's called Western Pangaea, which is the supercontinent, so what's currently the Western United States, through into China. So that would all be one landmass, and there'd be a continuous equator. And the swamps, it depends where you are in the Carboniferous. It's a long time period, but if you were looking at the Pennsylvanian part of the Carboniferous, the upper Carboniferous, you would probably be somewhere between Kansas, which is roughly in the center of North America. To the east, you would run probably to about the Donets Basin, which is in the Ukraine and Russia. So a big piece of territory.
Yeah, so it sounds like this was a really extensive habitat.
Right. It was extensive for a couple of reasons. One is that not only were all the continents aggregated into a single giant continent at that time, but what's called the aspect of the continents was different. Although there were mountain ranges, and some of them might have been quite high, there are also vast shelves. We have rather narrow continental shelves today. During the Carboniferous, some of the continental areas were under very shallow water cover over very great areas. And so what that means is as sea level changed, huge areas could be covered with these swamps. There are some swamps measured in the United States, which is what I'm most familiar with, that run from Kansas into West Virginia, which is thousands of kilometers, and the whole coastline would be swampy for miles and miles inland.
Let's talk about practicalities. What clothes should I pack if I'm going to venture into these swamp forests? I mean, what's the weather going to be like on a typical day?
What should you wear? Well, it may have been much cooler than we think. They may have not been steamy like modern tropical jungles.
Okay.
One of the reasons we believe that is because the great extent of the swamps, which are marked today by coal beds, they cover enormous parts of these exposed shelves. Well, to get the shelves exposed, you have to get the seawater off the shelf. And this is a glacial age. So it's actually the last glacial age before the one we're presently in. So you have glacial, interglacial cycles, just like we have today. So the way you're going to get that shelf exposed is to have ice. So the ice will suck the water up, pull the water off the shelf, and that'll expose the shelf. What that also does, at least the current model suggests it does, is it fixes something called the intertropical convergence zone, which is where circulating air masses collide around the equator. And that rains all the time. So what you get is a rainy belt across the equator because you have ice at the South Pole and cold at the North Pole, and it squeezes the tropical convergence belts from the north and south down around the equator, and it lets you have a whole lot of rainfall along the equator. So that means you're having relatively high ice volume and a wet equator, which makes it probably relatively cool. That might mean 22 to 25 degrees C.
Okay, so it's still warm.
It's still warm. It wouldn't be 40.
That sounds all right. I had it in my head that this was going to be really hot and humid and sticky, but that sounds a bit better than I was thinking.
And you would probably need a good pair of jungle boots, something that drained out because it's swampy for miles and miles and miles. And probably clothing that would protect you against the sun might be a little bit weaker then than it is today. And of course, you wouldn't have, as far as we know, you wouldn't have any mosquitoes or stinging bees or things like that. You might need some matches. Yeah, you probably want matches because there wouldn't be many rocks around to start a fire with. So you'd need to be able to get that fire going.
Talking about fires, one of the distinctive features of the Carboniferous is the high oxygen content in the atmosphere. It was much higher than today. So do I need to be extra careful when lighting a campfire? Because I'm a bit worried about accidentally starting a forest fire.
That's a really good question. Yes, you could be dealing with 28% oxygen. Some people have speculated it could be higher than that. At some point, organic matter spontaneously combusts, so I don't think we're at that level. But you are at the level where you probably could set a fire quite easily, and it might burn more intensively due to the oxygen content of the atmosphere. So yes, you probably would have to be careful, but it should be soggy and wet. You may have more trouble getting dry tindered, depending on what was going on at the time.
That's a good point. Now, let's talk about the plants, because easily the most striking thing about these forests are the plants that make them up. And they're not at all like the plants that we're familiar with today.
Right.
Let's start with the undergrowth. What types of plants will I be shouldering my way through during the Carboniferous?
You would have a lot of probably relatively thick undergrowth in places and other patches where there was nothing. It appears to be dependent on how much light is getting through to the forest floor. And that could have been a lot. There's some places where a lot of light made it to the floor. You would have a lot of small ferns. Most of them would not look exactly like the ferns you see today, especially if you're an anatomist. If you got into a little razor blade and started slicing them open, they would have anatomy that was different, and some of their reproductive biology would be a little bit different. But overall, they're related to modern, what are called Filicalian ferns. There are some other fern groups. There's a group called the Zygopterids that are different, and they're extinct. And you would run into a lot of shrubby things called sphenophylls. They're a group distantly related to modern horsetails, Equisetum. And they form shrubby masses on the forest floor. Some of them were climbers. Some of them are vines. Some of the ferns were facultatively climbers. And there are other little things in there. You might find some small lycopsids. There are a variety of scrambling small seed plants.
And then if I look up, I can see some really enormous trees with canopies maybe 30 meters above my head. What plants make up the giants of these ecosystems?
Right. That's where you really are into a different world. The giants are lycopsids, and their closest modern relative is Isoides, which is, unless you're a botanist, you probably don't even know what it looks like. On the surface, it would look like sort of funny-looking grass leaves growing around a pond. It tends to be aquatic to amphibious, which means it likes wet bottomland areas. It can grow at very high altitudes. There are Isoides known from up in the Andes Mountains, and they grow all the way down into the tropics. So a very widespread genus today, but it's little. You can hold it in your hands. And these guys are basically anatomically built on the same plan, but it's just expanded. And you have to understand that they're basically two growth forms. The ones that you see in the reconstruction show a tall trunk with this crown that opens up like the top of a broccoli or something like that. In fact, those trees spent most of their life growing without a crown. They grew as a telephone pole covered with leaves. And they had a trigger in them that at some point said, you're tall enough, it's time to reproduce. And then they would put the crown on, and they would produce all their reproductive organs in the crown, and they would die. They were what's called determinate.
Wow.
And so when you see one of those reconstructions that shows all these trees with their crowns on, they're all about to die. The whole forest, it's like a bamboo forest. If you believe that's how they grew, you would have the entire forest growing up, reproducing and dying. That's probably not how it happened, but who knows? It may. There are some evidence from a variety of environments that these plants may have colonized disturbed areas, moved in, sprouted, grown to these enormous heights, reproduced and died. So it could be that you had forests that were very synchronous in their reproduction. That's a possibility.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Along that line, too, those giant Lycopsid trees, you'll see in reconstructions, you'll see them laying on their sides with their roots hanging out, dangling down. Absolutely incorrect. They never came out of the ground. Basically, never. Their root system, something called stigmaria, are enormous. And they're surrounded by a cloud of things called rootlets. And the rootlets are maybe up to a meter long. And the root system might go out 10 meters in each direction around the base of the tree. And the trees can be growing together, and the roots could be all entangled with each other. We did some calculations on the back, literally on the back of a napkin, one day in a restaurant when we were on the field. A colleague of mine, Scott Ulrich, we just sat down and we cut everything in half, cut the coefficient of friction, the coefficient of suction. We just did everything we could figure out. And it would take the force of a Saturn rocket to pull one of those plants out of the ground. They are there for keeps. So I started polling my colleagues and asking some of them, have you ever seen one uprooted? And the answer was, no, never. We've seen broken off trunks attached to stumps, but we've never actually seen a tree uprooted. So the artists need to get it straight. They don't come out of the ground, even though it's nice to show. Some of the other plants in there may have been uprooted more easily. But anyway, that's one way to build a plant. It's got a very small wood cylinder. It's got a bark rind around the outside, and it could be up to 2 meters in diameter. And as you said, it could be 30 to 40 meters in height. So they could get really big, and they're just a very strange way to build a plant. The other growth type can also be quite large, and it's generally not reconstructed until relatively recently. And it's a very straight trunk, and on its sides in two opposite rows are small lateral branches that all the cones are born in. So as the trunk is growing, it's producing these two opposite rows of branches. The closest thing I could think of in terms of what's called plagiotropic habit. It's like a Norfolk Island pine. And when the cones were mature, the branch would fall off. So it's producing these two rows of branches up the sides and reproducing and reproducing and reproducing the whole time. And then when it reached the top, it would fork and it would continue to produce the lateral branches and it would fork and form a big crown, but all the cones would be on these little lateral branches. And then it too would stop reproducing and die. So the whole group are determinate and they have a limited lifespan.
As you venture into these swamp forests, the vegetation is often so thick that it can be difficult to see anything other than plants. But these forests are home to an incredible range of animals. You just have to know where to look. Along the riverbanks and in the flooded areas, keep an eye out for tetrapods. We first encountered these animals in the Devonian, the period that precedes the Carboniferous, but by now, they've diversified into a much wider range of animals. If you see something serpentine slithering through the water, it's not a snake. Snakes won't evolve for almost 200 million years. Instead, it's likely to be an aestapod, a primitive group of tetrapods that seem to have abandoned their limbs just as soon as they evolved them. Elsewhere in these waters, you might encounter basal amphibians, such as the temnospondyls. These range from small salamander-type animals to bulky, 2-meter-long creatures that lived and looked much like modern crocodiles, ambushing creatures at the water's edge. If you head onto dry ground, and if you're very, very lucky, you might catch a glimpse of the very first reptiles. These small, lizard-like animals are only a minor component of these Carboniferous ecosystems, but as the climate dries out in the subsequent Permian period, their waterproof skins and eggs will allow them to become the dominant animals on land. As amazing as the vertebrates are, however, the Carboniferous memories that will really stay with you, whether you want them to or not, are of the period's invertebrates, and specifically the arthropods. In many ways, the Carboniferous is the age of arthropods, because it's around this time that we see the radiation of a number of important arthropod groups, So, Russell, let's start with the basics here. What are arthropods?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So if you've never, for example, been introduced to arthropods in a museum or something like that, you may not realise that there is this group of animals. But they're actually incredibly successful, both in terms of their abundance, there are loads of these creatures, and in terms of their diversity, there are lots and lots of species. And they're these creatures which are kind of defined by a shared suite, we would say, of characteristics. These include an exoskeleton, they've got limbs which are jointed, they're split into things called podomeres. They often have a kind of specialization of body regions in a fairly predictable way. So if you look at, for example, a spider, it will have the front half and then the back half. And that's true of all arachnids. Or if you look at an insect, they will all have a head, a thorax, and an abdomen. So these are all features that arthropods share in common. There are five major groups, just FYI. That's the insects and their relatives. There are the arachnids and their relatives, so that includes horseshoe crabs, which aren't actually crabs, that's a whole thing. There are myriapods, so that's millipedes and centipedes in a couple of smaller groups. There are crustaceans, so that's the arthropods we tend to think of as food, prawns, lobsters. Also woodlice, not that we tend to think of those as food, but they're crustaceans. And then finally, there are the only extinct group of arthropods, and those are the trilobites.
I think as mammals, there's sometimes a tendency for us to favour vertebrates when we think about the history of life. But if we do that, we risk overlooking the phenomenal success story that is invertebrates, and specifically, arthropods. I mean, something close to 80% of all animals around today are arthropods, whether that's insects or crustaceans or arachnids or one of the many other groups in this phylum. So what's their secret? What makes arthropods so incredibly successful?
That is a really good question, and if I knew the answer to it, I think I would probably be swimming in grant money and incredibly successful. So we don't really know. But I also then, I question your question to an extent, and I apologise, in that we tend to be like, yeah, arthropods, they're really successful. And I wonder if that is the correct question to be asking, because actually, many arthropod groups aren't that successful, but there are a few that are incredibly so. If you go to, for example, the insects, and especially the coleoptera, the beetles, that is where you actually have this tremendous abundance and diversity. So actually, if we were to rephrase that question, we could say, why are insects that undergo complete metamorphosis so incredibly successful? And it's not just those. So I say, you know, endopterygotes, these things that undergo complete metamorphosis, really, really diverse and successful, and that's true. But their primary predators, the spiders, also incredibly abundant. And in terms of the arachnids, the mites are also incredibly abundant and diverse as well. And so we've got these isolated groups that are incredibly diverse, and then lots and lots of other groups that aren't. So I mentioned the myriapods before, millipedes, centipedes and their kin. They're diverse by mammal standards, but by arthropod standards, no member of that group has reached quite the eye-watering level of diversity that the insects or the arachnids, some of them, have reached. One way we can explain the diversity of at least the beetles and wasps, for example, is their mode of development. Having this development where you have a larva, you have this resting period where you basically rebuild your body and then you become an adult, we think may in many instances open up this wide range of different evolutionary possibilities that you wouldn't have if you didn't have that developmental plasticity. So if you didn't have that ability to, for example, compartmentalize your juveniles from your grown-ups so they don't compete with each other, and the ability to have this huge variety of forms in the adults could be one reason why they're so diverse.
All right, so let's head to the Carboniferous. Now, when I'm on my Carboniferous holiday, what arthropods might I see? What groups already existed at this point in Earth's history?
So, by the Carboniferous, all of the major groups of arthropods had evolved. So, when you're going out, you're likely to see some flying insects if you're in the upper Carboniferous. Probably also true in the lower Carboniferous, but we don't know for sure. You're likely to see some arachnids, and you're very likely to see some myriapods, all of those scrabbling around in the forests that were around in the Carboniferous.
Are there any particular species that I should keep an eye out for? Any that you think are particularly impressive?
All of the Carboniferous arthropods I've worked on are fantastic. So my blanket response is all Carboniferous arthropods are awesome and I can't pick a favourite. There are a number of species that people tend to kind of pick on as really iconic examples of Carboniferous life on land. And those are generally the very big ones because people love giant stuff. There are some interesting insects that became very, very large during the Carboniferous period. In particular, there's a group called the Meganisoptera, or the griffin flies, which are look superficially like dragonflies. They may be relatively closely related to dragonflies. We don't actually know what they were related to. This is an open question. But they grew absolutely huge. So there are fossils that suggest they had at least a meter wingspan. There are some error bars there. I think actually some fossils suggest significantly bigger than a meter, but I was conservative in my estimate. So they're really ginormous and they're huge and they're super, super cool. And they're probably predators from comparison to dragonflies. We don't know for sure. The other giant and really iconic species, or genus, I should say, that we have at this time are the arthropleurids. So this is probably a millipede. I say probably because, again, we still don't know for sure, but I think we're mostly agreeing nowadays that they are millipedes. And these were absolutely ginormous. They grew longer than 2.5 meters in length. And they were probably, based again on comparison with modern millipedes, they were probably detritivores, things that live on forest floors, eating leaf litter, whatever they come across.
What was it about the Carboniferous world that allowed some arthropods to grow to such monstrous dimensions? And why can't they do that today?
That is, again, a really good question, and I'm going to continue in my now, I think, fairly well-worn tradition of being like, we don't know the answer to that, but we can speculate. So for what it's worth, oxygen at the moment makes up about 21% of our atmosphere. In the Carboniferous, it looks like oxygen probably made up about 35% of the atmosphere. And one of the things that may limit the size of insects and myriapods is oxygen levels. The absolute limit of size in arthropods may be to do with the amount of oxygen they can get into their system. They typically don't have, and I say typically because there were so many exceptions to this, but typically they don't have a means like us of moving oxygen into their body and then pumping it out again, a diaphragm. And so they're limited to diffusing oxygen through their system, and that limits their overall size. And so it may be that because during this time period we had high oxygen levels, these organisms were able to grow significantly larger. Now, the reason I say that we don't really have an answer yet is because that's a very convenient explanation. And often in paleontology, we are, or if we're not, we should be, very wary of convenient explanations. And so until the last 10 years, there wasn't any kind of direct research to show that actually if you shove an insect in an oxygen tank, it gets a lot bigger. In the last 10 years, that has happened. People have started actually looking at the physiology of insects and trying to work out whether this high oxygen atmosphere may have allowed them to grow bigger. And the current research suggests that yes, it would have done. But then we also have to consider what else is going on in these ecosystems, right? It could be that gigantism is a result or a evolutionary response to predation. So we know that vertebrates on land were still relatively new. They came onto land about the time we start finding these giant things. They can eat arthropods, and there are many ways you can respond to predators, and one of those may be to grow giant. So it may be that as well as the oxygen that enabled this, there were other evolutionary drivers behind the gigantism. And I think, though I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I think that we don't really have a clear handle on the full range of possible drivers and which ones are most likely.
So I'm thinking about planning my trip to the Carboniferous, and for someone from the cozy, sheltered Holocene like me, the thought of giant millipedes and griffin flies the size of seagulls is, to be honest, a little upsetting. But should I be afraid? I mean, do these animals pose any danger to someone backpacking across the Carboniferous? Could they bite you? Could they sting? Were they venomous?
So there were some venomous organisms around. Scorpions were around at this time. They have the tail, one associates with a scorpion. They have the end of their tail, the stinger. So we assume they could sting. But in general, I'm going to go ahead and say, no, not really. They're nothing, I don't think, to be worried about. And let me explain my answer. Probably you're thinking like giant arthropods. Of course they're going to attack me. I think you could take one of those on in a fight. Certainly the millipede, the giant millipede, I don't think is going to care about you because you're not a piece of detritus on the forest floor. We think the griffin flies, these giant insects, may well have been predators. But also, there's only so much strength you can get in arthropod cuticle, kind of the thing that makes the exoskeleton. And so I suspect if one attacked you, you would probably win in that fight. And what I would point out is that in today's world, actually, arthropods do kill a hell of a lot of people, but not through biting them or stinging them, but actually through being vectors for disease or through parasitism, through all of these kind of insidious, fairly nasty elements of the natural world. So during this time period, it would be wild speculation to talk about what diseases were doing, but we're relatively confident that many of the parasitic lifestyles that we associate with insects and mammals hadn't really evolved at that time period, because mammals hadn't evolved at that time period. It's very hard to prove either way, but it seems relatively unlikely that this early in land ecosystems, that these really complex interactions between different groups of species had built up. Though bear in mind, that's wild speculation, and we can't be sure either way.
I guess there's only one way to find out, isn't it, really?
Yep, that's to visit the Carboniferous. Good luck. May the odds be ever in your favour.
Thank you. As amazing as these swampy forests are, for someone who wants to visit the Carboniferous but doesn't really want to spend their time getting wet and trudging through all this water, is there anywhere else that they can visit? Do we know what other habitats might have existed at this point in time?
Yes, indeed. If you want to stay with the tropics, you can just go west. And you'll end up in the western part of Pangaea, which is much drier, just like many of the western parts of continents are today. So you could go out there and find probably Mediterranean-type floras throughout much of Kansas to New Mexico, northern Mexico, and so forth, probably up until you get into the Permian when it starts to get a little bit hotter and drier.
And do we know what types of plants made up this Mediterranean-style flora?
Yes. Because we're in a glacial age, we're seeing glacial advances and retreats, many of them. Unlike our modern glacial age, we've had a few glacial advances and retreats. During the later part of the Carboniferous, you might have 50 of them or more, and all different magnitudes, big glaciations, little glaciations, and they have a rhythmicity to them as well. And during the times when the ice melts and sea level comes up, that is associated with warming and probably some drying in the central coal basins. The coal swamps basically fragment into refugial wet areas, and these plants from out in western Pangaea come in. So we can see them in the coal basins during these times between coal formation. And they would have conifers in them. They would have some cycad-like plants, something called Taeniopterus. There are a variety of unusual, strange things, Megalopterus, Leslea, the often big tongue-shaped looking plants. They look like a modern bird's nest fern, but they could be trees, fairly large trees. So primitive conifers and a variety of other plants that are associated with them make up the between coal beds floras. And when we go west, we find them all the time. They're just resident out there. And there it's flipped around the opposite. There you still have the wetland plants, but now they're living on stream sides.
You mentioned just then the fragmentation of these wetter habitats. And it seems this fragmentation happened on a very large scale at the end of the Carboniferous, in an event known as the Carboniferous Rainforest Collapse. Do we know what caused, or what might have caused, this event?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So within the Pennsylvanian, at what's called, in the U.S., is called Des Moinesian-Missourian boundary. At that boundary, there is a tremendous change in the lowland tropical rainforests. And there is a basically one or two glacial cycle change from a lycopsid tree-dominated forest to forests dominated by tree ferns. So what you really get is the collapse of the middle Pennsylvania swamps, a period where a lot of conifer-like plants show up in the middle, and then the rise of the tree ferns. So we know a lot about that boundary, and we can actually see that what seems to happen is you actually do get a kind of collapse of the middle Pennsylvania rainforest. You go through a period of what I call lottery-like dynamics, different things. So you come to the next coal bed, and this plant is dominant. You go to the next coal bed, and some other plant is dominant. And you go to the next coal bed, and some other plant still. And then out of that come the tree ferns. And once they get a grip on the system, they hang in there for 6 million years and dominate wetlands for another long period of time. Now that one collapses. That one goes into decline as you go into the Permian. Then these swamps begin to disappear as the climate continues to get drier and warmer overall.
And how did those changes affect animal life at the end of the Carboniferous and going into the Permian?
Again, really, really good questions. And we know, for example, that insect herbivory expanded greatly with the onset of Carboniferous wetlands. It's primitive, and it doesn't modernize until you start to get into the Permian. So you've got primitive groups of insects there, but they're definitely eating the plants, but at a much lower level than we see today. So that raises a real dilemma. Why? There's all this green stuff. These insects can eat the green stuff. Why don't they eat it? So it's why there's so little damage on these Carboniferous plants is a real question. For the vertebrates, there could be a strong effect of what's called facies, the type of environment that you're looking at. And most of the vertebrates from the coal swamps are aquatic. They almost all show some kind of swimming adaptation or linkage to water. It's when you start to dry things out that you start to pick up the more terrestrialized vertebrates, which raises the question, are they already out there and we're just not seeing them because of preservational conditions? I would guess that's pretty likely. There's a lot of evolution going on outside of our preservational windows, and it's real easy to collect in a coal mine. You got to go looking for this other stuff.
The light's beginning to fade now, so I think it's time I got out of the water and onto the relative safety of drier land. But before I set up camp for the night, I'd like to ask each of my guests for their one must-see Carboniferous experience.
Well, I think I would take a wide-angle lens and get into those swamp forests where all the really strange plants live. And I would find a dry patch, lay on my back, and take some pictures. What do these canopies look like? How big were these plants really? What in the world did they look like? You might want to drop straight into the middle of the rainforest, parachute in, have them drop you in with a good knife, some duct tape, and a rope. Because we do not know what a lot of these plants look like. People ask me sometimes, they say, well, we know what their leaves look like. Or we have fragments of their stems, but we actually don't have a good handle on the whole plant. So yeah, I'd love to see some photographs of what this was like.
And how about you, Russell?
I hope you will give me an entirely self-indulgent answer. What I would like to do in the Carboniferous is basically screw the later Carboniferous. The later Carboniferous is a time period I have worked on for much of my career, and there's loads of cool stuff happening, so I don't really mean screw it. But one of the reasons the upper Carboniferous, this period from 315 to 305 million years, one of the reasons that's really cool and exciting is because it's what I as a paleontologist would call a taphonomic window. So because of this situation with the low-lying forests, changes in sea level, inundations of those, we actually have quite a rich fossil record from this time period from 315 to 305, 300 million years ago. We've got loads of plants, quite a few vertebrates, quite a few arthropods, and that's all because conditions lent themselves towards preserving fossils in this time period. We know nothing, give or take, about life on land in the lower Carboniferous. Before 315, maybe 320, depending on where you are in the world, there are no rocks, really, that sample land-based ecosystems and actually preserve fossils. And so there were all of these major, really exciting innovations that happened in the evolution of these groups of life on land that we just have no idea of. Obvious ones for me to mention are the evolution of insect wings. Insects appear in the fossil record fully winged. They are a group that make up, as we said, a large proportion of living species, yet their key evolutionary adaptation, the wings, we don't know how that develops. It's not like it's a modified forelimb as we see in bats, in pterosaurs, or in birds. This is a novel structure, and where it came from, we've got no idea. By going to the lower Carboniferous, I would hope that I could see all of these cool creatures flying around, scuttering around on land, and be able to solve some of these unsolved mysteries. And it's not just insects. The origins of all of the major groups of arachnids that are still around today and myriapods that are still around today probably lie either in the late Devonian or in the lower Carboniferous. So that's what I would like to go and see.
And all that's left for me to say is thank you very much to my two guests, Dr. Bill DeMichael and Dr. Russell Garwood, for sharing their Carboniferous travel tips. If you've enjoyed what we've been talking about today, then make sure to check out their work, because they're investigating really fascinating topics in the history of life on Earth. And most of all, thank you to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and if you have, please feel free to like, subscribe, share, and leave a positive review. And I hope you'll join me again for another episode of the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. But until then, safe travels.